I have the same job description of introducing Richard and Robert, who need no description whatsoever. So I will say both Richard and Robert have been presidents of the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina. They've helped make the society what it is. And it really is a real honor to hear them again talking about the history of South Carolina. Richard and Robert.
Thank you.
I'm going to see if
that's the only time you can ever do that with a federal judge.
I'm going to see if we can't put the mic. Do I need to hold the microphone up? Do I need to do that?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, I want to thank Doris and the folks in Aiken. It's just a wonderful experience to be in this beautiful little synagogue, and it reminds us of the roots of Judaism across this state, and it is great to be here. Thank you for that. When we encounter Jews from outside South Carolina, and particularly outside the South, they say they're Jews in South Carolina, right? Then they say, why are there Jews in South Carolina? And it is with a great deal of shock they discover the history of this incredibly vibrant Jewish tradition dating back to the earliest settlement of the United States, and that Charleston at one point was the center of Jewish life in America. And the question is asked, why would that be? Why did Charleston become this vibrant center of Jewish life? And I think what Robert and I hope to do today is to talk about that early history, and how Charleston and then the rest of South Carolina came to play such a distinctive role in the early history of Jews in America. One cannot appreciate what South Carolina and the Carolina colony meant to Jews until you first appreciate what it was like to be a Jew in the old world. Virtually every country had a state religion. Now, that didn't just mean that particular religion got taxpayer dollars and was funded by everybody, whether you were a believer or not. But it generally meant that no other religion was tolerated, or if tolerated, only marginally tolerated. And it promoted a vast amount of anti-Semitism. And the lives of Jews were very constrained in these old countries. Our ancestors came here not because life was so wonderful there, but because it was not. Because people didn't leave with all they knew and their family and everything they were aware of to come to some distant land they did not know, right? Why would they do that? And the story of the Carolina colony is a story not just of Jews, but of other religious descendants who first came here because they were looking for a place where their lives would not be marginalized, where they would not be stigmatized, where they would not be discriminated against. And they were prepared to leave everything back in that old world. Let me talk just a minute about the origins of that sort of thing, describing the oppression of the old world to Jews and other religious minorities. Of course, we all are aware of the Inquisition in both Spain and Portugal. And that led, the Spanish and Portuguese Jewish communities of that era were remarkable in their accomplishment, in their wealth, in their success, and until there was the Inquisition, their acceptance in their society. And those peoples first went to other countries in Europe where they were also fairly marginalized. And then among the earliest New World settlers were these Portuguese and Sephardic Jews, these so-called Sephardic Jews. And they went to the West Indies, initially some of the earliest settlements in the West Indies, in Barbados, and in other West, Jamaica and others. Jews were very much prominent in those places. Let's talk about just beyond the, because it is well known about Spain and Portugal. In Rome, Pope, in April of 1775, so right on the dawn of the American Revolution, Pope Pius VI issues an edict prohibiting any Jew of Rome
being outside of the city for even one night. So you lived in a ghetto if you lived in Rome, and they locked that ghetto gate at night. Jews in Frankfurt in the 1700s were also confined to a ghetto after dark. Every Jew who passed through the gates of Dresden, every Jew, every animal, and every good got taxed. Jews were taxed as if they were an oxen. Jews in Austria were required to wear badges. We know about that during World War II. This was going on in the 1780s. In Austria, there was a law passed that a Christian could go to a Jewish synagogue on any day of the year and proselytize. And in one year, a minister showed up in a synagogue on Yom Kippur. And the Jewish elders of that synagogue objected and escorted him out. Thereafter, the synagogue was torn down by the authorities, and the leaders of the synagogue were exiled. And this is the kind of life Jews were living in old Europe. And even in England and Holland, which had a reputation of being a better place, Jews still lived in distinct areas of town. They were socially marginalized. In short, it was a pretty tough place to live and survive as a Jew. Now, meanwhile, you had this Carolina colony being formed. It was a gift of Charles II to eight noblemen who had assisted him in restoring the crown after the removal, toppling of his father, Charles I, and ultimate execution. These eight noblemen who had supported him became known as the Lord Proprietors. And the Carolina colony was a vast land extending from Virginia to Spanish Florida. And no one knew how far west it went. Some of those maps, Robert, went to go all the way to the Mississippi River. I mean, it was a vast land. But nobody really wanted to live there because, you know, they had malaria and yellow fever. Didn't nobody knew those names. You know?
Yes. And I think the important thing is this. Carolina was formed as a business venture. You know, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, you had a group of a very small minority. You know, the Puritans in American history come across as sort of heroic, the Pilgrims. But the fact of the matter is they were extreme reformers of the Anglican Church. Boston was found as the city on a hill. It was a religious experiment. And also it was extremely intolerant. I told somebody one time, every time I give a speech, I love to contrast Charleston with Boston. And the reason is because everybody thinks Boston is so wonderful and liberal. Well, the Jews were not allowed to live in Boston. The Jews could not live in the colony of Massachusetts. They were not allowed to live there. People who didn't agree with the Puritans were not allowed to live there. They had to go to my wife's home state, Rhode Island, the colony, y'all remember that. The point of the thing is that Charles II, Richard has a way of saying things in a more tactful way than I do, basically got his throne back and then decided to pay off his political supporters called the eight Lord Proprietor. And I always love this, the Lord Proprietor. A proprietor is somebody who owns something and is trying to sell it, okay? And what they owned was a bunch of land and they were trying to develop it. And basically, it was the most capitalistic. You know, people like to think of the South as not being the center of capitalism, but this was a real estate deal. And what they wanted was people to come and sell land and move things along. It was not a religious experiment. And so Locke's fundamental constitution, which many of y'all know about, says that the society would welcome heathens, Jews, J-U-E-S, and other dissenters. And as Richard Dyer...
From the Trump Christianity.
Right, exactly. And I said, well, we may be behind the heathens, but at least we were in the list.
And the top three.
Yeah, exactly. So the point is, Carolina comes along in 1670. Now, you know, Massachusetts Bay in 1612 is a big difference of what's going on in Europe at that time. First of all, Jews couldn't vote and were on extreme disabilities in Great Britain. It was no great liberal place either, much like today. But we won't get into events today. And so when they came to Carolina, they weren't in Massachusetts. And they weren't in some of these other colonies. So they were here, and they were welcome. And in fact, the proprietors were bringing in dissenters, which Richard likes to talk about, in order to develop the colony.
Right. And it wasn't just the Jews. It was the French Huguenots, which were Protestant Frenchmen from Catholic France. There were Unitarians and Quakers. And Robert is absolutely right. What the board proprietors were doing, they were a marketing operation. They thought these religious dissenters were a market for them. And putting the Jews in that fundamental constitution, and we joke about it today, hey, we're in the top three, we're right behind the Eagles. But that constitution was the first constitution in human history to provide for religious freedom. And it explicitly mentioned the Jews. And the Jews got it. I mean, they understood. And it didn't happen overnight, but slowly but surely, this Jewish community began forming in Charleston. We don't know for sure the first Jewish settlers. It's hard to know for sure. But they almost certainly were Jewish traders for Barbados. Jews had gone to Barbados. Barbados had been a thriving early colony. But the problem with Barbados was it was about 90% slaves, many coming directly from Africa. They were constantly having slave uprisings. And many people wisely said, this is like very uncomfortable here. And they began looking to other locations to move, some with their slaves. And the Jews were the master traders in Barbados. So those early Jews came. They were attracted. One of the aspects of that John Locke Constitution, and the whole history of that was, you know, we all know John Locke is the greatest political philosopher of his era. Well, he was also at one time a young man, right? And as a young man, he was close with Lord Shaftesbury, the head of the Lord Proprietors, who was also a believer in the religious tolerance. And he drafted this fundamental constitution. And one of the things said any seven people could form a church or religious institution. This is radical because before there could only be one institution. That one institution was the state religion. And here they're offering something fundamentally different.
And where they came from is a matter of some dispute. I know if you're really interested, James Hagee wrote a book, which many of you are familiar with, This Happy Land, The Jews of Colonial and Antebellum Charleston. He tries to track down who these people were. They came from England. Many of them, when we say England, they're the Sephardic Jews, which is the Iberian Peninsula. I guess the Jewish word for Spain was Sephora, and the Muslims called it Andalusia. And I wanted to say that I wanted to go back where Richard was a minute ago, just to give you a little perspective on this. The Spanish Inquisition is 1492, but the reason there were so many prominent, smart, and accomplished Jews in Spain was because of the Muslims. The truth of the matter is the Jews left Christian lands to go live in Muslim Spain.
Which is very tolerant.
Yes, very tolerant. So it is ironic that we're living in a time that's different from that. But the point is, for 500 years, it was a golden era of Jewish accomplishment in Muslim Spain. So, we just do have to take that into account. So it was when the Christians took over Spain that the Inquisition gets started. And so Sephardic Jews get spread out. They're in the Netherlands and England, which are really the only tolerant places. Semi-tolerant. So the Jews who come to Carolina are from, technically, I guess, from England and the Netherlands, but they are Sephardic Jews. And the mother synagogue of Beth Elohim, which of course is the first congregation, is Bevis Marks. I don't know if any of you have been to London, but if you ever go to London, you should see Bevis Marks, because Bevis Marks is the great Sephardic synagogue in London, on which Beth Elohim was patterned. It was a small, little sister version of Bevis Marks. So that is the direct connection. And the Jews came from the Caribbean. So after, in the 1500s and the 1600s, the Caribbean, Brazil, there are Jews living there. So they came from Barbados, Brazil, Jamaica, Curacao, St. Thomas, St. Croix, as well as from the Netherlands and from England.
Right. So this, you know, Charleston begins forming this small community. 1670 is when the colony is actually announced. First Jews are documented in 1695, and by 1697, a group of religious dissenters, French Huguenots and four Jews, are given citizenship in the Carolina colony. So what's a big deal about that? Well, I don't think Jews were citizens of England until 1740. So here they were getting recognized, they could do business, they were not being marginalized, and they began developing the kind of Jewish institutions that would create a center for Jewish life. So, Robert, why don't you talk about that?
And most of you know the history of Beth Elohim, and I'm not here to brag about it, because actually I was born and raised in Emmanuel, and my grandparents went to Bristol, but it has been a progression.
You are a member of
I am a member of Beth Elohim. Progression in the right direction. Anyway, my grandparents did not like that. But the first Jewish congregation is Beth Elohim, we think, although Sally Brebart has this other congregation that we talk about in Charleston. And they're meeting in homes in the King Street, Hazel Street area. So the synagogues at one time were on what was called Barefoot Street, which is now Fulton Street. So if you've ever eaten at Fulton 5, you're probably eating a location where the synagogue was. In 1749, the congregation had formed. So this is Beth Elohim, that forms a congregation, 1749. The building on Hazel Street, the synagogues were meeting in different places, buildings, second story of buildings, but the building on Hazel Street is 1791, which of course is one of the oldest synagogues. It's the second oldest synagogue in the United States, as you know. And the thing I want to stress here is it's an Orthodox congregation. You know, we tend to think of Beth Elohim as the mothership, you know, of Reform Judaism. But Reform Judaism was just a twinkle in somebody's eye in 1749. In 1749, they were Orthodox Sephardic Jews who followed the Minhag Sephardim, you know, the service.
That was it.
There was no Reform. There was no conservatives. There was no Conservadox. There was no Chabad. You know, there was Judaism, which is Orthodox Judaism. And the services were, I say Spanish and Hebrew. I noticed that Richard always corrects me and says Portuguese, but I'm going back to Spanish because James Hayes says Spanish, but you're saying Portuguese, but maybe it's a mixture. But in any event, and there was no English. But they looked to Baptist Marks for leadership, and they were asking them to send over a rabbi, and then they built a building. 1791 is a long time ago, and the gates around that building are the original gates. And these things are really national treasures on the National Trust. And you know, when you think about it, it really is quite incredible. Now, the building there now is after the fire of 1838, it was built in 1841. But the original building was a Sephardic synagogue with the, this is an Ashkenazi synagogue. You know, we're here in the front and you're there. But in a Sephardic synagogue, there are people on the left, people on the right, women in the balconies. And the whole layout of the synagogue is a Sephardic tradition.
The Jews start that group. Of course, you had to have 10 to have a minion, and that in 1749 they had a sufficient number. And Jewish merchants developed were very prosperous and very engaged in the business life of Charleston. Charleston was a bustling port. Was becoming very quickly in that era one of the most critical ports in the New World. Jews, as they became involved in business life, became increasingly involved in the civic life. And one of the sort of fascinating stories, you know, we hear about first, KKB is the second oldest synagogue in America, but the oldest continuously operating synagogue in America. It is the first Reformed synagogue in the New World, and it is, because of the horror of the Holocaust, the oldest Reformed synagogue in the world. But as Jews began becoming more prosperous, more mainstream, more accepted, they then became more involved, as Jews are wont to do to this day, involved in the civic life of the community. And one of the first we often talk about in our historical society was the election of Francis Salvador in 1774 to the South Carolina legislature. He was a Jew who had been born in England from a wealthy family. They were undoubtedly of Sephardic origin. They were a wealthy merchant family, and his uncle had purchased 100,000 acres in South Carolina, 100,000 acres.
Enough to build a Walmart.
Yeah, well, that's right. And it became known as the Jews' land of South Carolina. And it was up near Greenwood. And he sent his nephew, Francis Salvador, Joseph Salvador was the merchant, he sent his nephew to go settle the land up in Greenwood. Well, it was hard to get Francis out of Charleston, right? He did not want to go up to the woods, okay? And but he did begin going up there, and then he became very engaged in the revolutionary spirit. And when the first revolutionary legislature was elected in 1774, Francis Salvador represented that area of the state called, known as 96. And he, in his election, marked him as the first Jew in the world ever elected to public office.
I mean, this is an incredible thing. Here's someone who is from England, who is Jewish, and who's living around Greenwood in the country world. He is elected as a delegate to the first and second South Carolina Provisional Congress, which later became the General Assembly. At that point in time, Jews could not vote anywhere in the world. Anywhere. They could not vote in England until 1848. So he's elected to this provincial assembly, and Hagee points this out, you know, he served on various committees. He served with Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, the Draytons, the Middletons. He was very well thought of, and he was a soldier. And was involved in the debates in Congress, and was involved in combat, went out to warn his comrades of an attack by the Indians. Now, can we say Indians? Native Americans.
Who were allied with the British.
Yeah, the British were promising everybody everything. And so the Indians are out fighting with the settlers. So Salvador is killed, shot, and scalped. And his death was a very, you know, tragic thing for many people and leaders in South Carolina, and he was very well remembered by his contemporaries.
Was the first Jew to die for the cause of the American Revolution. Yeah.
And I said this, and this is a little snarky, but I really mean it.
Surprise.
In Philadelphia, they had the Museum of the American Jewish History, or whatever, in Philadelphia. I'm sure some of y'all have been there. And they can't find any war heroes or like real Americans to honor, you know, so they got Haim Salomon out there, who was the financier of the American Revolution. Well, cut me a break. I mean, Haim ought to be put, you know, behind a building, and Francis Salvador ought to be out front. You know, we have a war hero, you know, in South Carolina. And so, you know, these are things that I think, you know, give us a sense, and not just Francis Salvador, that there were so many Jewish soldiers in one company, Lushington's company, that was called the Jews' Company. Now, the Jews of Charleston and South Carolina acquitted themselves very well in the American Revolution. I found a quote last night from the royal governor who said, "The Jews, to a man, were violent rebels and persecutors of the king's loyal subjects." So the fact of the matter is that the Jews were on the right side, and they fought like men.
You know, it's easy to say, oh, how about Francis Salvador? Isn't that remarkable? But it was but one of many Jews who would later be elected to public office in this antebellum era. And the first Jew after the formation of the United States to be elected in South Carolina was a fellow by the name of Meyer Moses, who was elected to the House from Charleston in 1810. In 1817, Lyon Levy was elected the state treasurer, statewide office. And in Charleston elected in the 1830s, M.H. Mordecai to be the state senator. Talk about him a little bit.
Yeah, and this is where I think Richard died. And this doesn't mean there's not anti-Semitism in South Carolina. I don't want this to sound like, you know, kind of a Pollyanna story. There is anti-Semitism. There are discriminations against Jews, and Richard's going to mention one incident. There are plenty of incidents. You know, if you want to find bad things, you can find it. I mean, I noticed when I was writing Jewish Confederates, you know, it seems like all Jewish historians want to do is document every incident of anti-Semitism that ever happened. I mean, they forget about the Judah Benjamin, the most powerful guy in the Confederate government, you know, after Jefferson Davis, or they forget about, you know, the fellow I'm going to mention in a minute, a very powerful state senator, and want to talk about some incident that happened. And I think our point here is that, you know, when Hagee says this happy land, I mean, he's not kidding. So, you know, Moses coined Mordecai. I always have to laugh about this because I don't think anybody can mistake Moses coined Mordecai for being a Christian. I mean, you got to have, you know, it was a great story with Judah Benjamin. Some somebody, he signed something one time, and the magistrate wrote it down as Judas. He said, isn't Judah Jew enough? And I mean, the point I guess I make is that, and we always laugh about Ben Goldberg, our friend in Charleston, he says it wasn't pronounced more, we say Mordechai, you know, or you can say Mordecai, but for some reason Ben insists it was Mordecai.
Which is the way the North Carolina
looked. Mordecai was the way they anglicized that name. But here's the guy, you know, and I have a picture of him, I wish I could show it. He looks like Kramer on Seinfeld. You know, the guy is definitely Jewish. And, but he's the wealthiest Jew in South Carolina. He owns a steamship company, the Mordecai Steamship Company. He owned a mansion on Meeting Street, which is owned by Sue and Bob Printer, and they've been very
next door to the federal courthouse.
Next door to the federal courthouse, and I've got to give a plug for Ben Silver. So when you buy the tie, you're helping to preserve the house. And here's a guy who is in the state House of Representatives, all right, and is a state senator. And as I've said before, this is when a state senator really meant something. He was the state senator from Charleston County.
There was one.
One. Okay, and so this is a very important man. He's an ally of Calhoun, he owns a newspaper, and very prominent. He held a whole series of political positions. And he was, by the way, the president of K.K. Beth Elohim. So, you know, nobody was mistaking him for an Episcopalian, and he wasn't trying to pass. You know? So I think this speaks very, very well, you know, for the people of South Carolina, that they're electing a man who is Jewish, who's proud about being Jewish, he's president of his temple, of his synagogue. And now he did marry a poor girl from Columbia. You want to talk about her?
Not particularly.
Her name? Oh, Isabel Lyons, whose uncle was the mayor of Columbia. How many mayors of Columbia?
Two Jewish mayors of Columbia. But you know, it highlights Senator Mordecai was not the only Jewish elected official of that era. Sumter elected Franklin Moses Sr., a state senator in the 1830s. He later was a circuit judge, and subsequent to that was the first Jewish chief justice of any Supreme Court in America. Chapman Levy from Camden was a prominent attorney, was also very active in the Jewish community of Columbia. He was a state senator from Kershaw County. Georgetown elected three Jewish mayors before the Civil War, and Columbia elected two Jewish mayors before the war. So there was this incredible tradition of Jewish civic service in the antebellum era, and there was really only one other state that even remotely was similar to South Carolina, and that was Louisiana.
Yeah, let me read that.
That's a great quote.
I found this quote, but I think this is a William Howard Russell, who was a journalist during the Civil War, if I should know who he is. He's the author of My Diary, North and South. He says, "It is a strange country indeed," talking about Louisiana, which it is a strange country. "Indeed, one of the evils which afflicts the Louisianians, they say, is the preponderance and influence of South Carolinian Jews, and Jews generally, such as Edwin Warren Moise," we have some Moises with us today, "Mordecai Josephs and Judah Benjamin and others. The subtlety and keenness of the Caucasian intellect give men a high place among a people who admire ability and dexterity and are at the same time reckless of means and averse to labor. The governor is supposed to be somewhat under the influence of the Hebrews." Well, the point here is that Louisiana was under the influence, not of Jews, but of South Carolina Jews.
All members of
KKB. Judah Benjamin was born on King Street. His father was kind of a no-goodnik. He was kicked out of the Reformed Society of Israelites for not paying his dues, left his wife, and took up with another woman. We won't get into that story. His cousin Henry Hyams was from Charleston, was a lieutenant governor, and the district judge. So these are Jews from South Carolina who leave and go west.
And become public officials in Louisiana.
I mean, the truth is the membership of KKB spreads out throughout the South.
I also wanted that we had one of our pre-Civil War legislators who served from Chesterfield County, a very remote county on the North Carolina border, was Philip Phillips, who did not do anything quite remarkable as a as a member of the South Carolina House, but later moved to Mobile. Why don't you tell about him a little
bit? Yeah, this is a fascinating man. You know, he was married to Eugenia Phillips. And you see these couples, I'm not going to call any names, you know, where the man is kind of quiet intellectual and the wife is sort of bipolar, you know? And, it's that hysteria thing, you know. And anyway, she's a famous spy for the Confederacy. And he, meanwhile, is a very accomplished lawyer. In fact, he wrote the Kansas-Nebraska Act. He was a congressman from Mobile. He goes to Washington, you know, sitting in the Treasury. He and Daniel Webster and some guys sitting around smoking cigars wrote the Kansas-Nebraska Act. I think he was a congressman who created the Court of Claims. So, you know, we're talking about very, very impressive people.
And after he left Congress, he became the greatest appellate advocate in the 19th century, and he argued over 400 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, and in his retirement was recognized as the greatest appellate advocate of his day. Robert mentioned, you know, we're talking about all this, you know, acceptance of professional accomplishments, civic service. I think it would be unrealistic not to talk about at least some episodes of intolerance, because they definitely existed, as they always are, no matter how much Jews are accepted. The story that is sort of notable from that era was that there was a tradition in South Carolina of declaring a day of Thanksgiving. We know that particular Thursday in November will be Thanksgiving Day. Well, in the 19th century, it was simply declared locally, this is the day of Thanksgiving. And a tradition had been that our South Carolina governor would declare such a day, which would be a holiday, and it would invite persons to go to their religious institutions to thank God for the bounty among us. Well, on this particular occasion, the Governor Hammond, issued this proclamation, but instead of having the general non-denominational reference, he said that people should go to their churches to thank Jesus for the bounty. And Robert, talk a little bit about the Jews' response to that.
Yeah, there was an immediate reaction. This is really, Hammond was appealing, you know, to his political base, I guess. But there was meetings called in Charleston, the Jewish community, to petition the governor, you know, for relief. And Moses Cohen Mordecai, who's a state senator, who was very close to...
He's in the middle of all this.
Yeah, very close to... Aiken, William Aiken, if you go to Charleston, you'll see the Aiken House, William Aiken House. You know, he gets Aiken and some other people to, you know, let the governor know they're not happy about this. I don't know that Hammond ever backed up. But the point of the story is, though, is that the Jews would not take this thing lying down. You know,
you mentioned after they have this meeting and they criticize the governor for his lack of tolerant tradition, he then issues a statement and says that the Jews are responsible for the death of Christ. And of course,
small point.
They're like shocked. Okay, I mean, they're sitting there, and you seem to be accepted. And what I do, Belinda and I do in our book on telling this story, is of course the Charleston Jews have to start it, right? They stir it up, have a meeting, you know, they have to stir this thing up, and then they get the Jews in Columbia get whacked by the governor getting the statement. Well. The Jews are traumatized and shocked by this, but what we do in our book, we say, is the time this is going on, which is literally the last several months of Hammond's governorship, governors were then elected by the legislature. They even run for popular office. He was in the last months, and while he was getting into this fuss with the Charleston Jews, he also had an inter-family dispute of a rather significant nature. He had actually been sexually abusing his nieces, which were the Wade Hampton sisters. Well, let me just say, the Hamptons didn't take well to this, okay? So they were publicly denouncing him and said they were going to horsewhip him as soon as he stepped out of the governor's office, because he was guarding there. And so he's having this sort of family thing going on, and I frankly think the logical thing was he was trying to distract attention from the scandal by trying to go after the Jews. It didn't work. He slipped out of town several days before the end of his term. The Hampton boys did not get a hold of him. He slipped out of Columbia, and William Aiken, the Charleston, then the wealthiest man in the state, becomes the governor, very close with M.H. Mordecai. And the first day in office, he issues a new proclamation, which was like the old one, and the story was behind it.
Yes. You know, but the point is, in this era, in the 1840s, this is when the Bethlehem is built. What happens is in 1838, there's a fire. The Jews are always saying, well, if a synagogue burns down, there must be somebody behind it. But actually, it wasn't. It was just a big fire at Ansonbar. It burned up half of Charleston, you know. And so the synagogue burned down. So they built it back, and the present building is 1841. And to me, you know, this is really one of the greatest moments in the history of South Carolina. So they build this building. At the time, that building, Greek Revival building, was probably the most impressive, maybe the largest synagogue building in the United States. From 1790 to 1820, there were more Jewish people in Charleston than New York, Philadelphia, or any other city.
And people, a quarter of all the Jews in North America lived in South Carolina.
And it's hard to understand how that could be. But that is a fact. And the fact is that they found so much freedom and so much acceptance, and they could conduct business, and they could be elected, that this is where they wanted to be. So, you know, we're talking about the largest Jewish community in the United States. And Isaac Mayer Wise, who is the father and the founder, you know, of American Reformed Judaism, was invited to be the rabbi at Beth Elohim, which he very much wanted to do, but his wife didn't like the malaria and the smallpox and the heat. But, you know, but for that, Hebrew Union College, the American Jewish Archives, would be in Charleston. And so it was, in a way, certainly one of the main centers of Jewish life. And, of course, we couldn't have this talk without quoting my favorite rabbi. I wish he was still the rabbi at Beth Elohim, Gustavus Poznanski, who he said when the temple was dedicated in 1841, they had this big elaborate service. All the prominent people in Charleston were there, all of the Jewish and non-Jewish people are there to dedicate this temple. And he says, "This synagogue is our temple, this city, our Jerusalem, this happy land, our Palestine. And as our fathers defended with their lives that temple, that city, and that land, so will their sons defend this temple, this city, and this land." And so what you see when Hagee calls his book, This Happy Land, I mean, that's a good title. You know, what they were saying was, you know, we're not waiting to go back to Jerusalem, and we're not going to Palestine. You know, we're here. This is it.
And we're not going back to Europe.
We ain't definitely going back to Europe. And so, you know, this really speaks well. Now remember, in 1841, when this temple was dedicated, there's still no synagogue in Boston, Massachusetts. The first synagogue in Boston is 1850. All right. So I know that we all think of Boston as the home of American liberalism, but they hung Quakers on the Boston Common, something that never happened.
Wow,
we had a Quaker church. So when you hear all this condescending stuff from your New England neighbors, just pass this on.
Robert, let's still move into Jewish service during the Civil War, and there's nobody in America better to talk about this than you.
Well, you know, one of the things that when I did a book called Confederate Charleston, I was sort of amazed by, not so much that the Jews participated, because I would have expected them to, but how enthusiastic they were. And they were enthusiastic. I don't know if they were so enthusiastic about secession, but they, you know, they were so assimilated into the life of the city that, you know, they were part and parcel and part of the fabric of the society. I guess it would be, I would say, if, you know, people in this room would remember or would know that in World War I and World War II, nobody has to remember World War I, but World War II, everybody in the society was in favor of the war and out and supporting. Well, that's the way it was. And so you had these people. Now you have people in Charleston who are not Sephardic Jews, because now you have this migration of German Jews. About 1,200,000 Germans came to America in the 1840s. Of them, 125,000 were Jews. And so now KKBE, which was kind of Sephardic and Portuguese and English, but always had Ashkenazi members. I think it's a myth to say they were all Sephardic. But certainly by the 1860s, the synagogue is overwhelmingly Ashkenazi and German. And these Germans are poor, they're peddlers, they're shopkeepers, they're law enforcement, they're bartenders. You know, they're not doctors and lawyers. There's some doctors, and not a lot of lawyers. And they're not wealthy. These are petty shopkeepers, and they're in all kinds of trades. Cigar makers, there's all kinds of trades, shoemakers, tailors. And when the Civil War comes, the question is not why did the Jews support the Confederacy? The question would be why would they not? Why would they not? I mean, in 1860, they had been in South Carolina for over 100 years. Now in 1860, you have an Orthodox synagogue, Brit Shalom, and you have the temple, the Bethlehem, which is now Reformed, became Reformed in 1844, the Oregon controversy and all this business. And you've got a big Jewish community, and they rallied to the cause. Mordecai's ship, the Isabel, this is just sort of symbolic of where the Jews were on this. When Fort Sumter surrenders after the bombardment, and Major Anderson's men have to leave Fort Sumter, what boat do they get on? They get on the Isabel, owned by M.C. Mordecai, to go out to the Federal fleet. And people enlist, people volunteer. I'm not saying they were all enthusiastic about the war. In fact, I think there's an argument to be made that some, I don't know that Mordecai himself is in favor of secession. I think the Jews were nervous about secession. They were nervous about any kind of political change.
Yes,
the military. Yeah, you don't find a lot of Jewish fire eaters in secession. But once the war comes, they sign up because they feel this way. In their quotes in my book, if as Jews we are not loyal to the land that gave us this freedom, we will not be respected in our communities. So they go out and they volunteer. They're at the bombardment Fort Sumter. There's three Jewish boys killed from Beth Elohim at the Battle of Secessionville. They're all over the places. Captain Moise, who is, they like to call him General Moise in the Moise family, but I always like to say this. In Civil War history, the most common thing is called rank creep. Your ancestor was a corporal, and by the time you knew the story, he was a colonel. They got colonel and corporal kind of mixed up. Well, Moise was actually a captain, but he was a very important captain because he was Wade Hampton's captain of cavalry. So these are guys who get horses and are on riding horses and in the cavalry. There's a Moise's Rangers, which is a company organized, by a Jew. And the Jews are very, very, active in the Confederate service. Now, after the war, Moise becomes still Hampton's right-hand man and becomes adjutant general.
Then he became
a general. Now he is General Moise and headed up the red shirts. But the point is that the Jews, again, as they did in the Revolution, acquit themselves, in the eyes of their neighbors, admirably.
And, of course, as typical situation, as the war goes, everyone's waiting for Charleston to be attacked and toppled. And when Sherman begins his march to the sea,
150 years ago,
yesterday, the anticipation is Atlanta, Charleston.
Well, of course, because Charleston is the center of the universe.
Right, center of the universe, as they call it. So KKBE ships its silver and chandelier and Torahs to the synagogue in Columbia because they knew they were going to be attacked. So
bad plan.
And they make a feint towards Charleston, and of course the Charlestonians send all the South Carolina troops to Charleston, leaving Columbia completely undefended. But Sherman marches into Columbia, burns it to a crisp, and the Charlestonians, of course, are sitting down there. Of course, they no longer have their Torahs, their chandelier, or their silver, because they burned in the synagogue, the Columbia synagogue. But what is sort of interesting about the story is Columbia is, to have a city burned is a devastating thing. It leaves people homeless, they're starving, they're already... The normal economy is distressed by war, and then you have this. And a sort of interesting part of that story was that the Jews became very engaged in the recovery effort. In fact, Senator Mordecai comes up from Charleston and leads the recovery effort. He is in there. It's actually his sister, not his niece. His sister her husband had been, he was now deceased, but had been the mayor of Columbia. And he comes and he leads the recovery effort. And sort of an interesting story is that the Jews of Augusta. And you know, Augusta had this very old Jewish community, antebellum Jewish community, synagogue formed in 1836. And among the earliest members were Jews from Hamburg. Hamburg is the name of the town that later became North Augusta. Okay, and why did they do that? Because there was this horrible mass murder of African Americans right at the end of Reconstruction and became nationally known as the Hamburg Massacre. So they changed their name to North Augusta. But Augusta Jews were involved in this early experience with the formation of the synagogue in Augusta. So when the Jews, when Columbia's burned, of course Jews are burned out terribly, the Jews of Augusta have raised money and sent a significant sum of money to the Jews of Columbia to assist in the recovery. The Jews of Columbia, in response, take the money and give it to the general fund rather than keep it just for themselves. And that was widely noted, what the behavior of the Jews during the recovery period. There's a wonderful quote from our book that sort of tells that story. It was in the Columbia Phoenix, the newspaper. It says, "We have heard from so many sources of the handsome conduct of the Israelites of Columbia. And indeed, the subject is one of such general remark that it demands our public acknowledgement. No people could have been more active in their efforts to assist the sufferers during the fire, to protect, shelter, and provide for the destitute, the women and the children flying from burning houses. None have been more benevolent, more bounteous in the hungry, to the hungry and naked, more charitable in their gifts, more humane in their sympathy. We shall remember all such things."
And there's an attempt in the New York Times, as you would expect, to whitewash Sherman in yesterday's New York Times. I hope that you will remember all these things. Now to say he didn't really burn anything in the South. I'm just pointing out this is what's going on out there. I did want to give you this quote. Some of you may remember August Cohn and Company. It was a very big banking outfit.
Columbia.
I'm saying something good about Columbia. I want the record to reflect that. His father was Theodore Cohn of Orangeburg, and we were talking about Orangeburg a little earlier, the Orangeburg Jewish community. And this is kind of typical. People would come to New York, as the main port of entry, in the 1840s and 50s. But then some of them would seek their fortune in the South. So Theodore Cohn comes to Orangeburg, and when the war was imminent, his father, who was in New York, wrote him in German, "I want to tell you my very desire that you leave this unhappy country." We had happy land and unhappy country, South Carolina, "as soon as possible, because it will be ruined within a few years. I got you away from the old world, from the old rust fatherland, so that you would not have to serve as a soldier slave for an unjust cause. For what? The Lord make your mind clear and lead you as soon as possible." Theodore promptly enlisted in Company A, Haven's first volunteer, the Edisto Rifles. That's the whole generational thing. The fathers of New York, this is a crazy cause. The Jews in the North, of course, supported the Union, and the Jews in the South supported the Confederacy.
One of the effects of the devastation, and though Charleston was not burned, it was badly damaged during the Civil War. Columbia was devastated.
Yeah, and I want to say this. I gave this talk one time. Lincoln approved the bombing of civilians in Charleston. The Greek fire and all of that. And so when you think about all this, you can say, well, I don't relate to that. They bombed Beth Elohim Synagogue, the Union artillery. So I know some of your neighbors don't like Sherman, don't like the Union bombardment, but they bombed Beth Elohim. So just put that in your pipe and smoke it.
This is sort of when Robert and I part ways. But after the Civil War, the South and South Carolina was a much less attractive place for Jews. Many of the Jews of Columbia, Glenn and I traced, left. Columbia was devastated. They went to other cities, Baltimore, Philadelphia, etc. And the Jewish community was diminished. The synagogue in Columbia, having burned, was not reopened. That older Jewish community in Charleston, in Columbia, diminished. In Charleston, the synagogue struggled. It was a very tough time. And then, in the beginning, really in the 1880s, becomes the influx of the folks who are our ancestors, the Eastern European Jews, right?
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Charleston. You know, it's kind of a funny thing. You know, there's this whole history of the prominent Jews of Charleston who were both Sephardic and German, and Ashkenazi, and they're very something. And there's this whole very interesting history, but I just wonder when my father, when my grandfather, Sol Rosen, got off the boat at the Clyde Line Steamship Company at the end of Broad Street by 1908 and walked down Broad Street, what in the world did he know about that? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And so the Orthodox Jews who are speaking Yiddish and who are in their own little world, I don't think there's any connection there. I don't think that they...
They're not particularly embracing.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't know anything. And so, meanwhile, Beth Elohim, which had split, when they put the organ in there, that was just too much for some of the Orthodox Jews. It's one thing to have a Reformed synagogue, but an organ, you know. So they formed another synagogue on Wentworth Street. They have two synagogues. But when the war is over, of course, Beth Elohim is beat out. A lot of people had left the city. They couldn't make a living. So they had to get back together. They had to bring the synagogues back together. So what happens is Beth Elohim really struggled at this point. In the 19-teens and 20s, the synagogue almost went out of business. I mean, it might have been 20 members. I mean, how it stayed in business is really an amazing thing, because the Jews then were, after my grandparents' generation, the Orthodox Jews, and then now you have a big Orthodox congregation, later to become conservative. And after that, Reform, and after that, Episcopalian.
But this group of Eastern European Jews become the most remarkable, in themselves, form the most remarkable Jewish community in the world. I mean, it is... in size and in wealth, that's, of course, virtually everybody here's ancestors are those Eastern European Jews who looked, when they arrived, they spoke Yiddish, they wore funny clothes, they were people of modest means, they were not sort of very Anglicized Sephardic and German Jews. But they then set about to build their own institutions, their own history. And when you look at what America is today, it is primarily from these Jews. We've talked about the 19th century office holding, and that didn't end in the 19th century. In the 20th century, Jews continued to hold public office. We have one of them on our back row, Irene Rudnick, who served many years in the Capitol Assembly. We had Solomon Block, who was for 50 years the speaker, longest-serving speaker of the House. And then names like Israel Lurie and Hyman Rubin, Arnie Goodstein, Harriet Keisling, and others.
Yeah, and I want to mention Sam Rittenberg. You know, when y'all come to Charleston, go down Sam Rittenberg Boulevard, y'all are talking about a prominent Jewish political figure. And there hasn't been a whole lot written about him, but he served in the House 1913 to 1914, 1925 to 1932. Samuel Oscar Rittenberg, who many of y'all know the Rittenberg family, Henry, his son, just passed away. Again, this tradition continues, and I'm really having to take up for my family here today. They were talking about Orangeburg, and they were talking about the Jews of Orangeburg. I said, well, what about Louis Rosen, who was my father's first cousin, who was a circuit judge, and my other cousin, Nathan Rosen, who ran for the House and served in the House for 2 years. Not a very stellar political career, but nevertheless, he was out there.
And also the prominence of, I mentioned earlier that Franklin Moses Sr. was the first Jew to serve as Chief Justice. We had had two Jewish Chief Justices in South Carolina, the other being Julius Bubba-Ness. They have said the only Jew ever known Bubba-Ness, Bubba, right? But South Carolina, South Carolina Jews have played this, very prominent role in that has continued to this day, but its roots lie in the very foundation of this colony in 1695 forward.
And I do think we stand on their shoulders. I mean, one of the things that I think is important about the study of history is that the good feelings and the relationships that the Jewish community has had in this state is not based on nothing. It's based on something. It's based on all of these people having served their communities in an honorable way, having fought the American Revolution, having fought in the Civil War, having fought in World War I, in World War II. I mean, we are the beneficiaries of this goodwill. And so I think it's important, you know, to, I say take pride in our ancestors. At the time of the Civil War, my ancestors were living in a shtetl in Poland. That's what they did. But the point is, we do stand on their shoulders. And I think there's a lot of goodwill toward the, you know, the Jewish community in South Carolina today. And I think in some part, at least, because of what these people did.
Thank you very much.